We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. After World War II, thousands of African Americans moved from the South to Chicago, hoping for a better life. The city quickly became the most segregated in America, and there are a number of things that have been blamed, including family dysfunction and white flight. However, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 argues that the true causes lie elsewhere. Our guest is Beryl Satter, and she is a professor of history at Rutgers University in Newark. She was raised in Chicago. She's the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title is Family Properties, Race, Real Estate, and the Exploitation of Black Urban America. It's published by Metropolitan Books. And in the book, she makes the argument that, in fact, it was widespread legal and financial manipulation faced by black families that led to this pattern of segregation. The book explores that, and we'll be talking about it in this hour of the show. Professor Satter, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me onto the show.
The story here, I think, first of all, it's an interesting story, but the story behind the story is also interesting. That is the story of how it is that you started to explore this territory, because, as I explained, you're an historian, but this particular kind of history, urban history, the history of real estate in Chicago, that was not something that was part of your work before, and probably if you hadn't had the kind of family connection here that you can explain, you might not have written this book.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I am not an urban historian. I'm a cultural and intellectual historian. But my father was involved, deeply involved, in fighting real estate exploitation in Chicago. And he died when I was very young. I was 6 years old when he died in 1965. He was young. He was 49 years old. And it was my interest and curiosity about my father, about his work, about his legacy, about some of the mixed messages that I got about him growing up that provoked my desire to explore this whole subject of real estate exploitation in Chicago.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about him, and particularly how it is that it seems that in some people in your family talked about him as being a great guy and had done important work for people, and that other people thought that he had essentially been a failure and he left the family impoverished.
Right. That was his dual legacy. My father had been a very prominent attorney and activist in Chicago in the late 1950s up until his death in 1965. He was known for fighting for the rights of, particularly the rights of African Americans who had been swindled out of their properties. And this made him a hero in many people's eyes. He was one of the few people to take on this issue, one of the few white people, that is. And he really pushed the white establishment to try to address the problems that were going on in Chicago. Not that they responded, but he tried. So on one hand, there was, I would hear from my mother, you know, your father was very important in Chicago. He was very prominent. He was a great crusader, and you should be very proud that he was your father. But on the other hand, my father had invested in properties on the west side of Chicago, which was the very neighborhood where many of his clients were from, the people who were being swindled out of property. And he had property in the same area. He was both a crusader for the rights of African-American homebuyers and himself a white landlord in a black neighborhood, what had become a black neighborhood. And this put him in a very just tense position, trying to maintain his properties, which was not always easy, fighting for black clients who couldn't pay a lot. When he died, his properties ended up being worth practically nothing. They were more or less given away after his death, and my mother was left with five children and no partner, no husband, and no real source of income. And the tragedy and irony here was that my father had invested in those properties hoping that they would support his family were anything to happen to him, because he was always in somewhat fragile health. He had a very bad heart murmur, a damaged heart valve, and he always knew his life might not be long. And so he had invested in these properties specifically to care for his family, but in the end, some of his relatives anyway felt that by doing so, he had doomed his family, that he should have never invested there, that he should have sold as soon as the neighborhood started to change from white to black. He should have gotten out right away. Instead, he stayed out of ideological principles and thereby hurt his family terribly after his death. So that was the I knew both of these things, and I thought, you know, there's how does this all play together, you know, in one larger story about the city of Chicago and about the stresses that racial change in a context of unequal access to credit and home mortgaging and home purchasing, what does that do to people, both black and white, in the city of Chicago? And I knew that because of my father's unique position as someone who both, you know, knew profoundly what was going on in terms of white real estate trickery, yet at the same time was a homeowner himself, that dynamic would help me get deeper into the question of how both blacks and whites were affected by racial change in Chicago.
Just maybe one further question. Was there, you mentioned the fact that your dad passed away when you were six, and that this now, this digging into the record, trying to see if you could understand a little bit more about him and about what was going on at that time, that was something that you undertook when you were an adult.
Right.
Was there something in particular that
triggered it? You know, I think I always knew that I one day would have to figure out who my father was. It was very important that one of my older brothers, Paul Satter, he had saved my father's papers after my father's death, and it was only in the late 1990s that I realized how many papers he had saved. I thought he had only saved a small amount, but it was around 96, 97 that Paul showed me that he had actually, you know, boxes of stuff, and I thought, wow, that's a lot of material. By then, I was already a trained historian and understood that if I can get in there and find stuff, I would know a lot. It was about 2,000 pages worth of material. So there was, on one hand, just the access. But I think on the other, it was just the time had come. I was, you know, I had already published one book. I was secure in my profession, and I knew I was ready to turn to this mystery that had been with me basically my whole life. Of, you know, the mystery of who exactly my father really was.
Before anyone who might have just have tuned in, let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Beryl Satter. She was raised in Chicago, Skokie, Evanston. She chairs the Department of History at Rutgers University in Newark, and she is the author of the book Family Properties, Race, Real Estate, and the Exploitation of Black Urban America. The book is published by Metropolitan Books. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, it was one couple in particular that came to your father looking for help that got him more and more involved with this particular issue, that is real estate and predatory lending practices and discriminatory lending practices. And this happened in 1957. A couple named Sally and Albert Bolton came to him looking for help. They were being evicted from their home. So what were the circumstances?
Sally and Albert Bolton were Chicagoans who bought a property for $13,900, which was a high price back in 1955. And 2 years later, they fell behind on a payment, and the man who sold it to them said, okay, now you're going to be evicted. I'll keep your down payment. I'll keep everything. And so they came to my father and said, is there some way you could slow this eviction down? You know, give us a little time. And my father said, okay, I'll look into it. But he was struck by how high the price was, $13,900. So he did some research, and he discovered that the man who had sold them that property for close to $14,000 in 1955 had purchased that property only a few weeks earlier for $4,000. So that's an immense markup. So when he found that out, he thought, you know, this is way out of line. But it was worse than that. The man who sold them the property, first of all, he sold them property that he himself owned and never admitted it. He claimed to be just a real estate broker. So that's unethical. Second, of course, he about tripled the property price, you know, which you don't do. Third, when they said, well, you know, it's a high price, but we just want to, the Bolton said, you know, we just want to go consult an attorney and we'll get back to you. The real estate broker said, oh, no, you don't need an attorney. I'll be your attorney. I'll take care of everything. By doing that, he acted as their attorney in order to swindle them by selling them his own property at approximately triple markup, more than triple. And finally, he ensnared them in a contract that put them at huge risk. He had them buy the property. He offered them the property for sale on contract, which is at the heart of my book, this idea of selling on contract. And what that meant, the core issue here was that in the 1950s in Chicago and basically throughout the country, it was very hard for African Americans to get regular mortgage loans to buy property. In part, that was because of the policies of the Federal Housing Administration, which refused to insure mortgages on property purchased by African Americans in white neighborhoods. So if they want to leave the ghetto and move into a better neighborhood that was, you know, usually a majority white neighborhood, by moving there, they couldn't get a loan to move there. The Federal Housing Administration would insure the loans. Private banks, savings and loans also would not make such loans. So they were vulnerable. If they wanted to buy, they had to buy some other way than the way most white people buy, which is with a mortgage. So what this real estate broker had done to the Boltons was say, I have a way to help you buy. You'll buy on contract, which means essentially buying on an installment plan. And what that meant was that the Boltons put down a down payment. It was $750, which may seem low, but in those days in the 50s, you could put $500 down and get a new house in the suburbs. So it was not an unusually low down payment. In fact, it was a moderately high one. It was, you know, probably in the average range. They put a down payment down. They make monthly payments. They're responsible for taxes, interest, maintenance, and insurance. So it's just like a mortgage in all those ways, except if you buy on installment, all of these installment contracts had a clause that clearly stated if you missed one payment, you lost the property. One payment. So that meant you were incredibly vulnerable, you know, especially given if you're paying more than you should for the property in the first place, your finances are already stretched just to buy the property. Then if you miss one, the seller takes it right back from you and can resell it and can do that over and over, each time keeping the down payments that the buyer made. So that's what happened to Sally and Albert Bolton. They made the down payment. They made their monthly payments. They were charged about triple of what the property was worth. They missed a payment and were thrown out.
That's. I just want to underline that to make sure that people hear that and realize what the terms of these kind of contracts were. And we can go on and later and talk about the implications. But just to make sure people understand that they heard that right. Yes, I mean, not only were people buying something at inflated value, and were, as you say, responsible for paying the taxes and, of course, the upkeep and all of that. But all it would take would be for people to miss one payment, and the seller could, in a sense, repossess the property, take it back, and the people would have lost everything. They would have lost their down payment, everything that they had paid to that point. And I think that it was the case with the Boltons that they had been making payments on this property for, a couple of years?
Yeah. I think about 2 years. And it was over $3,000 that they lost by having it repossessed. And, you know, in 2 years, $3,000 in 1955, 56, 57, it's a lot of money. And it's, you know, it's a heartbreaking amount because it's money you save, and then where's your down payment for the next property? You don't have it. So, yes, that's what it meant. And to get a sense of, so through these people, through the Boltons, my father heard this whole story, and he was shocked by it, and he, and then as he looked into it more, he realized something that black Chicagoans already knew, which is that most black Chicagoans bought property in this manner. They bought it on contract. They bought it, I think it was 85% of the properties sold to African Americans were sold on contract. And in 1960, there were about something like 820,000 African Americans in the city. The number would soon rise to 1 million in Chicago. So this is a lot of people buying on terms that leave them incredibly vulnerable to losing the property. And forces them essentially to do whatever they can to not lose that property, to keep up those payments. And I think that is the second step of the tragedy that contract selling provoked.
Yeah.
If I could explain that, or
let me just ask one other sort of intermediate question here.
Sure.
Did the buyers truly understand the terms of the contract? Did they know what it was that they were getting themselves into and the great risk that they were exposing themselves to?
I think that probably varied quite a bit, but most of the time I would say no. They signed a contract. They were told, don't worry, it's going to be fine. You know, I mean, some of it depended on whether the seller, the person who sold them the house, had an underlying goal of getting the house back, in which case they would be less likely to explain the terms. Or if they said, oh, I'll sell out in triple price, let them buy it all together, and then maybe they would explain it. I mean, I've seen these contracts, and it was, you know, tiny, tiny print, and it was, I think, usually number 13 of the list of about 20 fine points, and it was, I mean, it was stated clearly if you're looking for it, but it was in legalese, you know, it wasn't the clearest language about the seller repossessing. So I think it was easy enough to not quite get that, to think that you're buying the way people buy, the way black people buy anyway, the only way you're being given a chance to buy. And then suddenly, you know, the day comes and, you know, oops, you're late, you miss it, and then you get that eviction notice. And so, you know, it was easy enough to lose the property. And in the through the early, mid-50s, through the 1950s, I'd say, there were lots of evictions. You had big contract sellers, speculators who were buying from whites at close to or below market value and then reselling to blacks on contract at double to quadruple market value. And they were happy to sell over and over because there was such an intense demand for housing among African Americans who their numbers were tripling the numbers of blacks in Chicago in the post-World War II years, yet the property available to them, the parts of Chicago that were open, quote-unquote, to black residents, you know, were so few that there was this intense market of people ready to buy at these high prices. So the people who were selling on contract knew that if the person did default, miss a payment, and they take the house back, there's always someone else to sell it to.
Yeah.
Once that started dying down by the 60s, they were less likely to evict with one missed payment because they weren't positive they could resell. But it was basically a system that was all set to work in the favor of the seller and against the interests of the buyer.
And apparently at this point, the Urban League, the Chicago Urban League, estimated that white real estate speculators doing this, turning the property over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
were making something like, it's hard to believe these figures, and I think your dad thought it was even more, but I think the Urban League said they thought it was $1 million a month.
Exactly, right. And my father thought it was $1 million
a day.
And they fought over that, over those estimates. But it was an immense amount of money in the 1950s, just a heartbreaking amount. When you think about this money being extracted from a community, the black community of Chicago, that is doing okay. Now, they're getting on their feet, but they can't – who can carry that kind of extra load of you know, money being skimmed away through these means?
Just very quickly, let me again introduce our guest, Beryl Satter. She's professor of history at Rutgers University, Newark. She actually chairs the department there of history at Rutgers, Newark. She grew up in Chicago, was raised in Chicago, in Skokie, and in Evanston, and is author of the book Family Properties, Race, Real Estate, and the Exploitation of Black Urban America, and it's published by Metropolitan Books. And, of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's take that next next step and talk about what this practice meant for the community. We can see that people would be under tremendous pressure to make the payments because they knew if they missed a payment, if they missed just one, they'd be thrown out. So making that payment had to be the number one priority in their life.
Right. And if the houses had been sold at a fair price, something close to their value, and something in line with what people could afford, it might not have been such a harsh situation. But because the houses, again, were routinely sold for double to quadruple their value, the payments were inordinately high, and yet you couldn't miss one. So this put immense pressure on Black buyers who are buying on contract in this way, in the hopes of bettering themselves, in the hopes of moving to a neighborhood outside of the Black Belt, which was densely overcrowded. So what it meant for them is that, yes, they didn't want to miss a payment. So if you had a family where just the husband was working, the wife would get a job as well. If both were already working, the husband would get a night job as well as a day job. They would try to bring in extra tenants into the property because they needed the extra money. So that meant they would overcrowd their properties. And, of course, they couldn't afford anything for maintenance because you can't do upkeep when you can't afford to miss a payment and the payments are, in fact, so high. So what you had in neighborhoods where contract buying predominated was African-American families killing themselves, essentially, to make those payments. But what it meant for the community as a whole was that there were lots of people who were overcrowding their properties, neglecting their maintenance, working long hours so that the children were unsupervised. And, of course, once lots of Black people started to move into these urban neighbors, these changing white neighborhoods, a lot of times city services declined as well. So the whole neighborhood began to go into a downward spiral. And the heartbreaking aspect of this is that here you had Black families working as hard as they could work to keep up their payments and to keep the property. But what their white neighbors saw was something completely different. Instead of seeing heroic sacrifice, they saw Black people moving into the neighborhood. For some unknown reason, they're overcrowding their properties, they're not maintaining them, they're not there for their children, their kids are running wild, what's wrong with them, And so the white neighbors see decline when Black people move in. They don't understand the cause, but they see the result. And understandably, they see, a neighborhood going down and they want to leave. And the only people who they can sell to are the very speculators who will then turn around and sell that property on contract to Black families at high prices. So It becomes a downward spiral for all concerned.
And as you mentioned earlier, the problem here, the reason that that Black families couldn't get conventional mortgages was the FHA. They wouldn't underwrite the loan they wouldn't insure the loan. But so it was next to impossible for Black families to get conventional mortgages. On the other hand, white speculators who wanted to buy these properties, they had no trouble.
No trouble at all. Right. They had very close relationships with savings and loans, specific savings and loans, who were happy to fund them knowing that these speculators would just use this money to flip these properties in this outrageous way. And that was one of the things that my father wrote about and spoke about often. He said, the savings and loans here are at the heart of the problem. They refuse to loan to creditworthy Black families, but are more than happy to loan to these speculators who aren't buying homes for the purpose of home buying. They're buying it as a speculative investment that will only destroy the communities in which they operate. And given that savings and loans were supposedly chartered to make the purchase of property, viable, he said they're going against their charters. They're going against their very purpose. They're using their financing to destroy neighborhoods rather than to create solid neighborhoods with homeowning citizens. So it was very ironic and very tragic that the setup worked this way. But it was very profitable for the savings and loan people because the speculators paid very high rates for their loans because given how much they were inflating their prices, they could afford to.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them, starting with someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I understand you're mainly studying redlining and, you know, the way the economics of it, but I'm wondering whether you didn't also look at, like, city and county policy, urban renewal, and building with Dan Ryan and things like
all
that.
All right. All those things, of course, play a role, because what urban renewal did, and what highway construction did, for that matter, was increase the pressure on black families. It was usually black families, black communities that were torn down for urban renewal. It was those neighborhoods that were destroyed, leaving black families desperate for homes, you know. And again, in Chicago, there were only so many places they can go. There were many neighborhoods where they took their life into their hands if they tried to buy there. There were, you know, massive riots by white people against, you know, lone black families, that, you know, one person, you know, one family that bought a house in a white neighborhood. They would bomb the house, break the windows, and drive them out. So, you know, so here the neighborhoods they are living in are being destroyed because of urban renewal and highway construction. Highway construction often went through black neighborhoods, through the heart of black neighborhoods, or on the outside in order to contain them on one side of the highway and whites on the other side. All these things played into segregation, but again, also intensified the pressure, the desperation for housing, which was a desperate need that these speculators who sold houses on contract were quite happy to exploit.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether anybody's looked through the history of property transfers and saw that the speculators are the people that, in the pattern of Cook County, knew where the developments were going to happen, so that the African Americans who actually might have benefited and been able to buy up if there was some place to go with this money from, you know, this eminent domain, but most likely it was...
It was flipped by people who had insider knowledge, insider connections.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to caller and on a cell phone here, line number two. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
And good morning, Professor Satter. As a historian, I'm particularly fascinated by the connection between personal experience and work as a historian. So the conversation at the very beginning of the hour was particularly exciting for me. But I'd like to turn the discussion in a different direction, I think. You know, having watched urban renewal in my own hometown, which destroyed a healthy African-American neighborhood in the late 50s and early 60s, and I was wondering, as you described the nexus of inflated prices, predatory contracts, and then, you know, provoking the need to take in a border or to, to take a second...
Overcrowd the property.
Yeah, and to sacrifice maintenance and things like that. It prompts me to ask something, let's say, more sociological and more closely related to things like the so-called pathology of the black family that Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote about in his work. Mm-hmm. And that is that this seems also a perfect ideological engine for white exploitation to create a demonstration that says we sold African Americans these perfectly good houses.
And look how they've torn them down.
And look at how these people can't be trusted with them. The neighborhood has gone to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it becomes a kind of engine for producing, Reagan's favorite, you know, the welfare queen in a Cadillac, the kinds of anecdotes and data that can...
That is then used to blame the victim. That's right. I mean, that's part of the heartbreak and the tragedy of all this, is that the results can then be used to feed a belief, like you said, an ideological system that blames the victims themselves for the problems. That, you know, look, we sold them perfectly good properties, and look how they can't maintain them, and, you know, look how they tear down their own communities, and it's all their fault. So, sure, it looks that way if you don't know the pressures that these people are laboring under, and if you don't understand the complete lack of choice they've been given. I mean, despite all of the pressures and despite the incredibly high payments, there were always some people who managed to make those payments and keep up their properties. And, you know, carry on. But it was against obstacles that no one should have had to have faced. And so, but absolutely, you're right, that it did, by the mid-1960s, feed into this culture of poverty analysis, which just simply said it's all their fault. You know, all you have to do is drive through the neighborhood and you could see the kids, you know, running wild and the property's not maintained, so who's to blame but them? That became the right-wing interpretation of what happened in Chicago and in many cities, of course, across the urban north. On the liberal side, people would say, you know, if only white people hadn't left, everything would have been fine. What's wrong with the white people? Why did they flee? And I think that is also misguided because it makes it sound like there were no economic pressures to play at all, that it was a matter of goodwill, and if only the whites had just stayed, everyone could have lived in harmony. But given the FHA policies and given the redlining policies, the refusal to insure mortgages, and the policies of banks and savings and loans to refuse to make mortgages in racially changing neighborhoods, the whites who stayed there didn't have many choices either. If they stayed, they knew that week after week their property was worth less and less. And who are we in hindsight to say, you know, well, you should have done that anyway, you know, because in fact if those who did lost out as well.
Not only that, it strikes me again, just to pick up on what you just said, that the cycle gets even worse, because as whites leave the neighborhood and as, you know, the economic forces that make it difficult to maintain properties continue, the political clout of a neighborhood in terms of getting, you know, getting or keeping decent schools and public infrastructure and police protection, fire protection, all that political support dissipates. And so I suspect that what you would find if you looked is that, that police pull resources out, fire department pulls resources out, sewers and streets are less and less likely to be properly maintained.
Sure. I mean, here you have population densities, you know, doubling or, you know, dramatically increasing. And often this happened in neighborhoods that had been overcrowded to start with. They were white working class neighborhoods. These weren't elegant neighborhoods in the beginning. So they become densely overcrowded, and all the city services either stay the same or decline. That's absolutely right. And as far as political representation, in Chicago, especially on the west side, you had a situation where there were these white aldermen who had represented the community when it had been white, and they didn't even live in those neighborhoods anymore. They had ghost addresses, claiming to live there when they didn't. And basically, these communities had no political representation because their quote-unquote representatives didn't represent their interests. And, you know, you had such a tight democratic machine in Chicago that these people could be elected over and over. And it wasn't until, well, I mean, within a few years, there were challenges to these ghost aldermen. But at the key moment when political clout was needed, it wasn't there.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We certainly have time for other callers. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Beryl Satter is our guest. She chairs the Department of History at Rutgers University in Newark and is author of the book Family Properties, Race, Real Estate, and the Exploitation of Black Urban America. It's published by Metropolitan Books. I wanted to come back just for a moment to your dad and to the Boltons, because as we explained, they had bought this property on contract, had been making payments for a couple of years, but as was the feature of this arrangement, if you missed a payment, you could be evicted and you'd lose everything, and that was their circumstance, and they came to your father to see if he could help them. There was nothing contract selling was not illegal, but you did have this, at best, unethical arrangement where their realtor that they had used was the property owner, so he was their realtor. He was also the seller. He also acted as their legal advisor. How did your father try to argue this?
He understood that, in fact, no law had been officially broken, that a contract is a contract and you could charge what you want, and if the person signs, they sign. But what he argued was that even if the behavior in this case was not illegal. It was clearly unethical. He argued that when you offer to act as someone's attorney or as their real estate broker, you have a fiduciary relationship with your client. A fiduciary relationship means that you agree to act in their interest, not in your own interest. So an attorney, you know, you don't go to an attorney and the attorney acts on the attorney's behalf. The attorney acts on the client's behalf. So what he argued was that the Bolton seller had by offering to be their attorney and by being their real estate broker in both of these capacities, in fact, had a fiduciary relationship with the Boltons and hence should have acted on their own behalf, on the Boltons' behalf. But instead, he acted strictly on his own behalf and manipulated that client sort of relationship in order to extract money from them. So that was his argument. It was a reasonable argument, but it didn't work. The judge ruled that, sorry, they signed a contract, there's nothing illegal here, contracts are sacred, and that's it. So it was sad. You know, they lost that case. My father won some cases. He lost many also. I mean, he did best when he pressured the sellers to settle out of court. Sometimes he was able to do that and get big reductions for his clients. But often in court, the judges tended to rule that a contract is a contract, and we don't care if there was bad behavior in the course of getting the person to sign it, that it wasn't it didn't quite cross the line. And the contract sellers were very clever and basically knew how to keep their behavior just within the law so that the law protected the speculators but did not protect the buyers.
Let's take some other callers. Next, Muhammad, line one. Hello.
Hello. I can't help but think that there's a parallel that between what's happening in real estate right now, all the failing loans, which should never have been given to these people for huge houses they could never have afforded. It just seems like you're just telling the story of what has happened recently, the real estate bubble bursting.
Yes, and I think there's very, very strong parallels. I quote Patricia Williams. She's a legal scholar in the book. And, she says that the ghetto lending practices of the 60s have metastasized, and she says we are all in the ghetto now. And I think that's a very powerful way of stating that, in fact, many of these underhanded practices that in the 1950s and 60s were concentrated in black communities spread by the 1990s and certainly into the early, you know, this century, all across the spectrum to people of all colors and all economic backgrounds. So the issue of fiduciary relationships, that was perverted. And you had brokers who, instead of looking out for the interests of the buyers, were basically working instead with the lenders to manipulate the buyer into indebting himself or herself at the highest possible rate at the highest possible interest because that was the most profitable loan to make. You had inflated prices. There are some differences, of course, in that in this current cycle, people were willing to indebt themselves in the hopes that the property would simply go up in value, and that was what everyone was hoping for. And that was not exactly what was going on in the 1950s and 60s. But the idea of lenders, real estate brokers, and mortgage lenders knowing that they can make the most money by making harsh loans, irrespective of the people's ability to pay, that's a common thread.
All right. I'll go to a cell phone caller here again, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I've just been listening for the last half hour, but it's very enlightening because I had relatives that were sold during the redlining, and I understand them better now. And I will read the book. But I wondered if you have anything to say about the dynamics of race and real estate and movement in the city of Chicago right now, because it seems like the gentrification that's spreading west and south is simply displacing the poor, and most of them are black, And it's just a whole new wave of at least economically based terror that's being being perpetrated on the citizens of Chicago. And the city is just changing enormously, and I don't know the basis of that in a real estate context.
Mm-hmm. I haven't studied gentrification, so all I can say about it is that anytime people of low income are displaced in order for people of higher income to take their place, it hurts those low-income people. It puts them in an even harsher vice than they were already in, because we don't have options of comfortable, humane, low-income housing. It's just never been a priority since the 1930s, and it's leaves people ripe for manipulation. If it does end up paralleling what happened with urban renewal and highway construction in the 60s, 1950s and 1960s, what it will lead to is a worsening of the neighborhoods where they can't find housing. They'll be doubling up with neighbors. Things will get more overcrowded and more decayed, and they will probably once again be blamed for these terrible conditions that they find themselves forced to live in.
Yes, in our own town, in Champaign-Urbana, we have a patchwork of what you might call ghetto and very wealthy areas, and some of them are homes that were built in the 60s, not very well, working class homes that I think are owned mostly by others and rented to poor, and then others are very old on the north end, dilapidated and possibly owned by the people that live there. But the living conditions in parts of our own town are also very bad. And I don't know that there's a big turnover and that real estate selling has much to do with it. But anyway, very interesting topic.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go on here. We have a caller in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I'll ask your guest, did you use the term masticizing of the process?
Yeah, I quoted another scholar who said that ghetto lending the ghetto lending processes of the 60s have metastasized, i.e., spread dramatically.
Well, that is a term that's applied to cancer, isn't it?
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the point of my call.
Mm-hmm.
That. My listening to the program and people calling, there again, it appears to me that the symptoms are being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Masticize of the process is a symptom of a deeper sort of ailment,
mm-hmm.
which tells me that the process of capitalism is now masticizing, becoming worse. And the people who pay the price for the greed of others have no defense. And the symptoms that keep accruing behind the capitalist system, you know, one of the urban blights or things used upon the urban community is eminent domain as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, that urban renewal uses eminent domain as a legal method to take property from usually minority homeowners who are living in areas that are coveted by big business. But as far as metastasizing, yes, ghetto lending practices have metastasized, was her quote. And it's these lending practices, I mean, this issue of capitalism, one thing I talk about in the book is, you know, I try to make very clear, people think that there's a free market, you know, and that there's a free market in housing, and you buy and you sell, and that's that. But what I show in the book is that there's not a free market. There's a dual housing market, a racially divided housing market. There are probably dual racially divided markets in other types of goods as well, but housing is quite primary. And So capitalism, you know, isn't even working the way people think it should work, ideally. You know, we haven't even gotten to that, much less, I mean, how it would work if it worked fairly, not based on our racial divides. You know, I don't know. We don't have it. It's theoretical, unfortunately. But I think it's part of what the people who I write about in the book, the activists who, after my father's death, organized to fight exploitative lending, they just wanted a fair capitalism. They didn't want to abolish capitalism. They didn't, you know, they hadn't had a chance to really participate it, to participate in it in fair terms. So that's I think what their answer would be. Well, let's see how it works if it was fair, if all the cards weren't stacked against minorities, and you know, we're willing to go with that, but we'd like to at least get there.
We're coming down. We just have a couple of minutes, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. Thank you. I hope you won't mind if I jump in here, because I wanted to at least have you talk a little bit more about that last thing that you touched on, because I know that you're one of the stories that I think you really want to tell in the book and you wanted to document was another untold story, and that was the story of the way that people like your father, but a lot of other people, organized black contract buyers to try to get
right
things to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. In 1967, that was the beginning of organizing on the west side of Chicago, which was by then pretty much entirely black. The contract buyers, the people who had bought there, began to come together and realize that they were that you had whole big communities, you know, huge areas where the vast majority of property had been sold on contract, often just by a few individuals, at exploitative prices to people who are, you know, again, fighting to keep these homes. So the black buyers in the late 60s organized into a group called the Contract Buyers League. And it's an untold story. And, you know, it's amazing that the story isn't known, because most historians anyway, know that Martin Luther King went to Chicago in 1966 and was not successful at organizing black Chicagoans. What they don't know is that a year later, black Chicagoans did organize on the West Side into the Contract Buyers League, thousands of people coming together to fight something very, very complicated, that is real estate exploitation and redlining. And they stood together. They tried to they picketed the homes and the businesses of the men who had sold them properties at these high prices. They asked only that the contracts be renegotiated so that the sellers made a 15% fair profit, as they called it, rather than a 80% unfair profit. When that didn't work, they launched two major legal suits against the contract sellers of Chicago and against the banks and savings and loans that funded them, and ultimately against the FHA itself. So here were, you know, black West Siders, many of them migrants from Mississippi, people who, as one of the earlier callers said, are blamed as, you know, pathological, as having a defective culture that, you know, is the reason why the communities were in bad shape. Here are these very people coming together to risk quite a bit, because By fighting their contract sellers, they could have lost out. One of the ways that they chose to pressure their contract sellers was to go on a payment strike, which was incredibly risky and incredibly brave, because by refusing to make the payments, they could be evicted. And then many were evicted, and it turned into a major standoff and a major political battle in Chicago that I detail in the book. Ultimately, their struggles against these sellers and against the banks that funded them led to the compilation of evidence that was drawn upon when other Chicago activists like Gail Sincotta created laws against redlining in the 1970s, and ultimately was drawn on the data that they collected, and the data of their lives, in fact, was drawn upon to help pass the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and the Community Reinvestment Act, which were both passed in the mid-1970s and which are hugely important federal laws aimed at stopping the redlining that was at the heart of the problem on the west side of Chicago and in many urban neighborhoods.
And when the FHA, was that, how significant was it when the FHA changed its policy and began to insure mortgages that previously it wouldn't have?
You know, that came a little too late. That change was in the late 1960s, and by then the neighborhoods had mostly changed over and people were already ensconced in their contracts. I mean, it's important in that it's just, you know, but even when they shifted policies, they still didn't quite do it right. I mean, instead of saying, well, we will insure the mortgages of all people, irregardless of race, based on their individual creditworthiness, something like that, they just said, we will. They had a policy which then was later shifted again, saying that they would insure mortgages in all low-income, quote-unquote, meaning black, usually, communities. It was, you know, again, too late. It was a policy that left that was also open to exploitation, because if you insure mortgages 100%, then the lender has no reason to check on whether you're creditworthy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they kind of swung wildly to the opposite direction. I think the laws, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and Community Reinvestment Act, were ultimately in some ways more important because they held banks – first of all, they enabled people to see – the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act forced lending institutions to say – where they were making their loans, so that you can see, oh, they're making no loans in certain areas. Because the FHA is only one lender. You know, it's only one way to get a loan. It's not, you know, you can get a loan without FHA insurance. You can get a loan from a private, you know, savings and loan without it. So, I mean, the FHA was important at a historical moment, but it wasn't the, it doesn't mean everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's more about how the private banks follow suit. Mm. So the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, by forcing lending institutions to say where they make their loans, you can see where private banks were redlining. So even if the FHA doesn't redline and private banks still do, it doesn't help that much. So the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act showed where redlining was happening, and then the Community Reinvestment Act gave a leverage to get those banks to loan in the places where they take deposits. If they take your money, they need to loan back to you.
We're going to have to leave it at that. We've come to the end of the time. The book is Family Properties. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Our guest, Burl Satter, is the chair of the Department of History at Rutgers University in Newark. And Professor Satter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.